How we balance the tension between the short-term demands of our reptilian senses, run, and our longer-term desires, goals, and commitments that we try to set with the more evolved parts of our brains. It's why I've come to visit him on this gray day in early December 2012. I'm trying to better understand why two rocket scientists are dead. Was it because Reggie, for some reason, lost his focus? Was he distracted? What was happening inside his brain? Can the research being done here and by a new generation of neuroscientists prevent similar tragedy? Does science offer any solace, some hope, for the families of Keith and Jim? More basically, what is attention? Dr. Ghazali smiles. What is attention? Attention is a complicated thing. He pauses. It has many subdomains. It falls into an aspect of cognition that's related to the selection of information to be processed. Oft-cited on this subject of attention is William James, a philosopher and physician at the end of the 19th century, and the brother of novelist Henry James. William wrote of attention in 1890. Everyone knows what attention is. It is the taking possession of the mind in clear and vivid form out of what seems several simultaneous objects or trains of thought. Everyone might know what it is. Might. But as Dr. Ghazali notes, more than a century after Dr. James, what we think we know, or what we once thought, has many strata. It's complicated. Dr. Ghazali says that attention is also absolutely critical for all high-level functioning, a cornerstone of what it means to be human. He's not just saying that our attention allows us to survive, say by being able to attend to a threat or perceive an opportunity. He means that attention allows us, in a uniquely human way, to set goals and follow through on them without being distracted by every bit of stimulation around us. It allows us to interact with the world through our goals and not be led by or be a slave to our environment. It has allowed us to do every remarkable achievement, creation of society, culture, language. They're all dependent on being able to focus on our goals. To illustrate how attention works, Dr. Ghazali has an idea. He suggests I come to his next First Friday cocktail party, his monthly hipster soiree. Learn about attention at a party? I'll show you the cocktail party effect. Chapter 4. Reggie. Mom, what's gonna happen? Reggie asked. Everything's going to be okay, Reg. Mary Jane's voice could strain a bit when she got excited. She and Reggie in particular had a playful relationship. He'd tease her gently, but he was always listening and always attentive. He sat in the passenger seat of his mom's Chevy Blazer. It was just hours after the accident, and Mary Jane was driving him home from the hospital. She'd decided to take an alternate route, using side roads, circling around a chunk of Valley View Highway, so Reggie wouldn't have to pass the site of the wreck, where mop-up and accident reconstruction were still underway. They hit the crest and started sloping back down toward Tremonton. They passed through Beaver Dam, a small town. It was light now, but raining. Waiting at home was Reggie's dad, Ed. He wasn't sick with worry yet. He'd been heading out the door to work when Reggie had first called from the side of the road. Initially, he had just said he'd been in an accident, and Mary Jane had told Ed it didn't sound that bad. Reggie said someone had swerved into his lane and that he was unhurt. So Mary Jane sent Ed off to work at the machine shop where he was the foreman. But as soon as she got to the scene and realized what had happened, that two men were dead, she called Ed, and he went right home to wait. There still wasn't any indication Reggie could be at fault, but Ed obviously wanted to be there for his son. What's gonna happen? Reggie again asked his mother. I don't want to go to jail. Everything was going to be okay, she told herself. Reggie was a polite boy, and the son who'd already survived a few challenges, the concussions in football, that goofy, lovable awkwardness, the odd birth. The day he was born in late January 1987, Mary Jane's doctor wanted to be there for the birth, but also to leave on a family vacation. He induced labor by stripping Mary Jane's membranes at his office, and a few hours later, Ed hustled her to the hospital. The baby came a few hours later, on the early morning of January 28th. They had to suction his head to get him out. He came out with a cone head. Mary Jane laughs when she tells the story. I told the doctor to put him back in because he wasn't done yet. She and Ed hadn't yet thought of a name. A black-and-white television hung in the corner of the delivery room showing Pope John Paul II. His name, in Italian, was Giovanni Paolo II. It sounded a bit like Reggie. It was kind of sacrilegious, the devout Mormon says of naming him for a pope. But it just kind of fit. Reggie had been the second-to-last child of six, the siblings spanning an age from Vicky to Phil to Jake to Nick, who was 18 months Reggie's senior, and his pal and constant competitor. Later came Whitney, born in 1999 when Reggie was almost 13. The Chevy they drove was nothing fancy, a standard model, but standard by then included some remarkable safety technology, like an anti-lock braking system, which allowed for swifter stoppage time and had first been developed in the 1960s. It had power steering. These were technologies that had been part of a profound effort to make cars and roads safer, along with airbags and billions spent to widen and improve roads. And yet, traffic fatalities continued to be a tenacious problem. The car didn't have a navigation system. Those were in their infancy, with the first TomTom Go GPS first appearing in the Netherlands in 2005. Soon they were everywhere. That's how fast things were moving on the technology front. Mother and son drove home from the hospital, mostly in silence. When they got to the red brick house, Reggie marched right up to his room. He lay down in the twin bed that was pressed against the far wall and turned on his side, away from the door. He put his cell phone on the bed behind him. He was exhausted, terrified, and unable to find any rest or peace. At the hospital, Rendlesbacher had suspected that might happen. Reggie's probably going to have trouble sleeping. Can you get him something to help if he needs it? This room was a particularly tough place to let his head clear. Not because it wasn't quiet, but precisely because it was so quiet. Hardly any traffic, not even birds, not at this time of the day in the drizzle. Through the window next to his bed, he could see the wooden jungle gym with the green slide, next to a one-bedroom brick cottage in the family's backyard that had in years past been home to local missionaries. Reggie tossed and turned. He looked at the ceiling, the red trim on the closet door, the bullhorn that hung over his bed, the radio station sticker on his door. His phone rang. He turned over and, without looking at it, sent the call to voicemail. It rang again, and then it started ringing regularly. Word was spreading. Reggie prayed. "Please let me go back and do it over. I would trade anything to go back." He tried to figure out what had happened, to piece it together. The last thing he remembered before the wreck was being on the opposite side of the road. But he couldn't figure out if he'd been the one to drive there, or if something had hit him or someone had pushed him there. Try as he might, he couldn't remember any sound of cars colliding. His first vivid memory afterward came as he walked from his truck toward the Saturn. There was this stout man with a handlebar mustache who was getting off the phone with 911. "What happened?" Reggie asked. The man was Kaiserman, the farrier. He responded, "You just hit that car." Tom Higgs, a manager of advanced engineering at ATK Launch Systems, saw Brian Allen stand and walk to the center of the room, right in the middle of a dozen creme-colored cubicles. Brian looked grave. "That wreck. I think Keith and Jim were involved," Brian said. He was one of Keith's best friends. Tom and the rest in the group had wondered why Keith was late, and they'd heard separately that there had been an accident on Valley View Highway. It was the route many at ATK took to this isolated, desert spot situated roughly between Tremonton and Brigham City. You had to be in the middle of nowhere when you were building and testing rocket boosters. Not just for the space shuttle, but for the military missiles. Brian had no further information, and returned to the phone to try to find out what had happened. His seat was located near Keith's in the mostly uniform batch of cubicles, but Keith's work area stood out for two reasons. He had a bigger cubicle, reflecting his status as a senior analyst and lead engineer, and his space appeared to be a mess. It was packed with piles of papers, journals, and reference materials, each standing 2 or 3 feet high. Stacks on the floor, stacks on the cabinets. To get Keith's counsel, you kind of had to sidestep your way into his cubicle to avoid the papers. And that's what people did. Came to get Keith's advice. They'd do so for engineering, of course, but they'd seek his help for physics and even software coding, a tribute to a rare depth and breadth of scientific capability. Over in the production group at ATK, a whole different division, they sometimes had trouble with a machine that inspected the booster rocket's O-ring grooves to make sure there was no corrosion. The production guys actually would turn to Keith to fix the software. His chief charge, though, was designing the next generation of rockets. When the government or defense contractor put something out for bid, the engineering team would use their computers to simulate new designs. The idea was to push the limits of physics and math, and of known resources and production capabilities, to create new generations of powerful, stable rockets. There were major league stakes, intellectual and scientific, financial and, less often discussed, military. ATK and its denizens might have bragged about their relationship with NASA and the space shuttle, and they were absolutely integral in helping redesign its boosters. But the engineers also spent time designing strategic rockets under defense contracts, something perhaps less politically correct to advertise. Trident missiles, ICBMs, Minutemen, nuclear weapons. The most powerful and deadly things in the world. Until several months earlier, Jim had worked in the same bunch of cubicles as Keith. Then he moved to another part of the building to take over a managerial position in a key project, developing a new, more powerful booster for the space shuttle. Brian, Keith's close pal and Jim's friend and colleague, returned to his cubicle to take a phone call, and less than a minute later, returned to the open area with an update. He was practically matter-of-fact about it, a reflection of disbelief, or perhaps the communication style of the engineering culture. Jim and Keith were dead. Van Park stood at the podium, shuffling papers, as the fifth-period students began pouring in. A boy approached. "Coach Park, did you hear what happened to Reggie Shaw?" Van shook his head. "He got into a really bad accident." It was early afternoon on September 22nd, a few hours after Reggie's car swerved left of center and hit the Saturn carrying the rocket scientists. Van wore khakis, a golf shirt, and tennis shoes. He stood 6 feet tall and weighed 185 pounds, fit, his head a bushel of blonde hair. On the wall of his classroom hung two flags for the Utah State University Aggies. There were posters warning students about the dangers of drugs and STDs. And there were three framed nature pictures, each one urging excellence with a word: challenge, determination, and success. It was room 157 at Bear River High School, coincidentally, the room that Reggie had taken his driver's education class in during his sophomore year. Van took a deep breath. The longtime health teacher and varsity basketball coach occasionally heard the rumors that whipped through Bear Valley High. So-and-so lost his arm in an accident, or so-and-so got arrested. And he always moderated his reaction until he heard what had actually happened. Two thoughts went through Van's mind. "I hope Reggie's okay," and "Valley View Drive can get real slick when it's wet. Must have been one of those bad roads." The boy reporting the news to Van had no further information. "Was Reggie okay? Had anyone been hurt?" Shrug. Van glanced out the window, into the seminary, a Mormon teaching center where students are allowed to spend a period each school day learning the gospel and earning credits towards seminary graduation. Van tried to put these thoughts about Reggie out of his head, even as the rumors continued to swirl throughout the day. But Reggie had graduated only 18 months earlier, and this was a small town in every conceivable way: size, population, culture. They supported one another, helped out in all the small-town ways. There were also dark secrets people didn't much talk about, along with a gray market of gossip that could spread the ill-informed rumor as fast as any IM or text network. Tremonton had been close-knit since it was settled in 1888 by folks of German descent by way of Tremont, Illinois. The settlers were largely Protestant, as compared to their Mormon neighbors. In 1903, when they formally incorporated as a township, they called their new home Tremont. But the postal service in Utah feared confusion with the town of Fremont, hence Tremonton. Then, Tremonton started to receive a heavy dose of Mormons, spreading out from Salt Lake City. They made significant outposts in Brigham City, just 20 minutes from Tremonton at the base of the mountains, and in Logan, the region's hub, which held a larger temple. It was a place for marriages and sacred ordinances, not an everyday church-going experience. Logan was at the base of the mountains, too, the ones that defined Utah in so many ways. When the prophet Brigham Young reached the base of the Wasatch Mountains, he reportedly declared, "This is the place." The mountains proved a natural border of sorts. They helped explain why the community could grow so close. The families in the city so interdependent, and their ideas in some ways so insular. It wasn't easy to go over the mountains, either coming in or out, bringing ideas or taking them away. Tremonton lay on the valley floor, making it good for farming. For many years it had an odor, a pleasant one, sweet and a little moldy. That was the product of the sugar beet plant located 2 miles north of town. Its aroma carried easily even with a light wind. The farms, like the 700-acre one that Reggie's maternal granddad Wilford once tended, grew beets mostly, and corn and wheat. There were cattle ranchers and dairy farmers, too. Everyone knew everyone, proverbially. And in the case of the Shaws, it was probably closer to literally. Mary Jane and Ed had gone to school there and married at a little reception center on Main Street when she was barely 18 and he was 19. Wilford, Mary Jane's dad, who was known widely as Wit, was gregarious and easygoing, a pillar in every way. Ed's family had a rougher go. His mother had had a debilitating stroke when Ed was 11, one of 7 children. The 4 older ones had more or less left home, but that left Ed at home with a mother who had lost her ability to speak and walk, and a father with a serious drinking problem. He wasn't a binge drinker, and not a mean drunk, but he'd be tough to match for consistency. He managed to get himself to work every day as a driver and odd-job doer for one of the town's wealthy businessmen, and then he'd come home at night and head for the bottle. His drink was whiskey. He'd hide it in the car. Every night, numerous times, he'd say, "I've just got to go to the car." He thought he was being sneaky, but he fooled no one. With his eye on the bottle, it wasn't on Ed. The young man would spend many nights away from home with friends. His absence, he said, unnoticed. He smoked cigarettes and he drank. He stayed in school, mostly to play sports. Then he met Mary Jane and got married, and she got pregnant. He was determined to be a more attentive father than his father had been to him. He swore off smoking and drinking. As a family, Mary Jane, Ed, and their 6 kids had a reputation for kindness and for their love of sports. The kids playing, and everyone watching and rooting. They'd go to the Utah State football games and travel to Las Vegas for the regional basketball conference championships. The TV was always tuned to some game or another. They never missed a game of Reggie's. While he wasn't a star, Reggie was a good enough athlete to develop his own modest reputation in the sports-crazed community. Maybe that's why, on the morning of September 22nd, news spread so quickly that Reggie Shaw had been involved in a bad wreck. Maybe it's because everyone thought that Reggie was such a good guy. Indeed, for Van, his old basketball coach, Reggie stood out because he was, in addition to being a strong guard with the will to rebound, a decidedly decent person. Van and his wife Lisa, a French teacher at the high school, her classroom is directly above her husband's, privately said how they wished they'd find someone like Reggie for one of their daughters. To Lisa, Reggie was a model kid, friendly, widely liked, quick-witted, but never seeming to crave the limelight. He got B pluses and A minuses in French, and even though he was a jock, he didn't mind being called on in class. Lisa thought of him as the all-American boy. As Van stood there waiting for the fifth period kids to finish filing in, he flashed on a moment from nearly 2 Januaries earlier. It was a day that had started with such high hopes, the varsity hoops team busing to Salt Lake for the state tournament. The team had reason for optimism. They were stacked with talent. Big, tough players like Jason Zundel and Dallas Miller. And they had in Reggie a tenacious defender and supporting player. He was the guard who preferred passing to shooting, rebounding to glory, was best friends with the studs, a bit in their shadow. Plus, Van thought, Reggie lacked the confidence to equal his talent and hard work. For all the team's talent, the state tournament did not go well. The team lost a heartbreaker in an early round and returned home the same day. Hours later, after it seemed everyone else had cleared out, Van walked into the locker room and heard the crying. Reggie sat with his elbows on his knees and his face down. He looked up. "I can't believe it's over." "That's why I love you, Reggie. You're so passionate about basketball." But Van knew Reggie's reaction was about more than a game. The season-ending loss meant the end of relationships and feeling connected, something the young man seemed to crave. Looking back on that day, Van thought of Reggie. He was almost as broke as you'd see with someone who lost a loved one. On the day of the accident, Van couldn't get the idea out of his mind that something bad had happened to Reggie. When he got home after school, he called the Shaws. He got Mary Jane. She said Reggie was okay. She said there had been fatalities. It was a word that, for some reason, Van picked up on. She didn't say dead. She said fatalities. She wasn't sure how many. Reggie was upstairs. He'd not come down all day. Hadn't eaten. Had entertained just 2 visitors, his brother Jack and his dad. There wasn't much to say. Van had a final question. "Was there anyone else in the accident from around here?" "No," Mary Jane answered. "They were from Cache Valley." That night, she and Ed talked about the questions Rendlesbacher was asking, suggesting Reggie somehow was at fault, and they were worried sick. Ed didn't express it like his wife, but there was a story he'd heard about, maybe read about in the paper, that was running around his head, making him nuts. It was this story about a kid in Idaho, 2 hours away, and in so many ways Utah's cultural and political sibling. Not too many months before, Ed remembered that there had been this young man, 18 years old or something like that, who had been arrested. He hadn't committed a big crime, some silly misdemeanor, but the cops had picked him up. Then they had called the kid's dad to come get him. The dad said, "Let him spend the night in jail. It'll be a good learning experience for him." In jail that night, some guys beat the kid to death, says Ed. As he recalls his thinking at the time, his eyes mist. Then a tear rolls down his cheek and he clenches his teeth. All I could think was, I cannot let Reggie spend a single night in jail. I will sell the house, I will do whatever it takes, but I will not let him spend a night in jail. Jackie had been numb all day at work, knowing the worst was to come. She had to tell the girls what had happened to their dad. After receiving news of the accident, she'd stayed at work until 3 in the afternoon. Then she went to school to pick up her oldest daughter, Stephanie, a real daddy's girl. Jackie's colleague Roy drove her in her own car over to Thomas Edison Charter School. Jackie gave the news to the principal and to Stephanie's teacher. Then she walked with Stephanie to her Saturn, just like Jim's, a practical car, navy blue. Stephanie had on her school uniform, the khaki slacks and polo shirt, her blonde hair in a protective braid because it was gymnastics day. Stephanie saw Roy, her mommy's work friend, and asked, "Are we going to gymnastics?" "Sweetie, there's something I want to talk to you about." Jackie sat down in the front seat and pulled her 7-year-old onto her lap. She realized Stephanie didn't have too much understanding about death, or at least she didn't have much experience with it, except for when they'd put Sandy, their chocolate point Siamese cat, to sleep 2 years earlier. "Daddy was in a car accident." Stephanie looked at her with those deep blue eyes. She never thought she'd have a blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl. "He didn't make it." Stephanie started to cry, and now Jackie did too. Stephanie curled up in her mother's arms. "I was holding her, and I was hiding her. From the world, everything. He's gone to heaven." They sat there like that for a while, Stephanie not speaking, not even asking questions. She didn't ask any questions. Jackie and Roy got her into the back seat. They drove to the daycare center to get Cassidy, who was just a few months shy of 4 years old. On the way, Stephanie finally offered up a question. "So are we going to do what we'd planned this weekend?" It surprised Roy, the sophisticated implication of the question. "Will life go on as usual?" A few hours later, people had begun to fill the Fafaro home. The phone rang. Jackie's mom picked up. It was a reporter from the local paper. Jackie heard her mom say, "How the hell do you think we feel?" and hang up. Jackie tried not to make a public show of her grief, trying to eat, not eating, shaking, trying not to shake, and thinking, "How am I going to do this alone?" It was already dark when Jackie carried Cassidy to the living room just inside the front door. A big TV stood in the corner, and there was a massage chair from Sharper Image. It cost $2,100, but it was worth it to help with Jim's periodic migraines. Jackie and Cassidy curled up on the dark tan fabric couch. The little one was a mama's girl who liked to lie on Jackie's chest. By then, Cassidy had asked when Daddy was coming home, and Jackie was trying to find the right moment. On the couch, she tried to calmly explain that Daddy had had an accident and had gone to heaven. "He isn't coming home." She wasn't sure how much Cassidy understood, and if Jackie was honest with herself, she wasn't sure whether she even believed it. "A small part of me thought, maybe it's a mistake, and he'll come home anyway." About that time, over in Logan, a woman named Terrell Warner pulled up in a blue minivan outside a gymnastics center called Airbound. The door pulled open, and Terrell's daughter, a sixth grader, chilly from waiting outside for a few minutes, climbed inside. "You won't believe what happened," the girl Jamie started. "Cicely told us that Stephanie's dad was killed in a car accident." Terrell paused and tried to catch up to the conversation. Cecily was the gymnastics coach. "Which one is Stephanie?" she asked. Jamie reminded Terrell that Stephanie was on her gymnastics team, the daughter of Jackie and Jim Fafaro. Terrell began to form a picture. She'd had modest interaction with the family, but liked them. She remembered 3 months earlier, the night before a statewide meet at Airbound, when Jim Fafaro and her husband Alan had to set up the fiberglass springs under the mat. They'd cut their hands on the fiberglass and had to go out and get gloves to finish the job. Meantime, Terrell had been trying to make some posters for the gymnastics meet. The posters had flames on them, but Terrell's drawings were so bad that they'd never been used. They were so awful that Jackie had laughed in a friendly way at them, something Terrell appreciated. She tried not to take herself too seriously. Terrell was shocked, of course, by news of the wreck, but she was used to hearing about tragedy. In her daily life, Terrell came across a lot of horrible situations. She was the victim's advocate in Cache County, which encompassed Logan. It was a particularly low-crime area, but it still had its share of particularly gruesome crimes, like rapes and child abuse. In Terrell, the criminals had a particularly ardent and zealous foe. She had a reputation for relentlessly pushing for justice, even among the prosecutors. Terrell connected to people who suffered tragedy in a very personal way. She spoke from experience. She'd been on her own improbable journey, a victim from a very early age, and she'd learned to fight back, for herself, for others. When her daughter told her about the car crash, Terrell didn't think about it in professional terms. After all, it sounded like it was just an accident. Besides, Terrell assumed it must have happened in nearby Box Elder County, which was home to both Tremonton and ATK systems. Not her jurisdiction. Mainly, Terrell thought, Jackie's going to be a single mom. What a terrible tragedy. Chapter 5. Terrell. In June 1980, in a room with bedsheets tacked up as curtains, a slight high schooler with brown hair was fast asleep when she recalls she was awakened by yelling. "Get out of bed! Get in here! I want you to see this!" It was the summer after Terrell Danielson's ninth grade year in Downey, California, a town near Compton, not far from Los Angeles. A tough neighborhood, but no tougher than what happened inside the walls of the three-bedroom house with overgrown ivy in the front yard that Terrell, her mom Kathy, and older brother Michael had given up trying to groom. "Get in here!" Terrell remembers her father yelling as she fought to get her bearings. She could see the .357 Magnum in his hand. "I'm gonna blow your mother's fucking head off!" It had been leading to this moment for a long time. A slow-motion wreck starting in August 1962, when Kathy, who was chunky and adorable with short blonde hair and had just graduated high school, gave birth to Michael. He was a big kid, but passive. Less than a year later, Kathy delivered again, this time with twins, Terrell and her sister Carol. Several months after she was born, Carol died. They chalked it up to pneumonia. Dad was Byron Lloyd Danielson. He built drive shafts at a local garage. He was big, 6'2" and 220 pounds. He was clean-shaven and kept his brown hair cut short. He was good-looking. He could be really sweet. There was this one time that he and Kathy and a bunch of their friends went to an Elvis concert in Long Beach. There weren't enough tickets for everyone, but he managed to score a really great one for one of Kathy's best friends, a better seat than anyone else's in the group. But things began to change for Danny, as the family called him, when he hurt his back at work. He started taking painkillers, and he drank. His personality changed. When he was drinking or popping pills, he'd go from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde, from Joe Mr. Nice Guy to a real a-hole. "You couldn't believe it was the same guy," recollects Nancy Smith, a close family friend. She remembers Danny always having guns, keeping one stored beneath the driver's seat of his car. Terrell's memories of terror start early. In the year before she started kindergarten, she was asleep in the family's previous house in nearby Linwood, in a room with yellow walls that she shared with Michael, when she was yanked out of bed in the middle of the night. My mom's face was bloody. They ran across the street to a neighbor's house. It was my first memory of violence. The family called Byron Danny after his last name, Danielson. Sometimes Dad, but often Danny. They stayed as far away from him as they could, as their tiny house would permit. There wasn't much of anywhere else to go, given the gangs and toughs who roamed the streets. Terrell retreated into books, anything she could get her hands on. She loved the Bobbsey twins. Kathy was a Mormon, and she would sometimes take the kids to a nearby LDS church. But Danny, not a Mormon, wasn't a fan of the activity. Terrell remembers that Danny, to make sure church wasn't an option, would sometimes take the distributor cap off of Kathy's long chocolate brown Cadillac, disabling the aging sedan. Kathy tried to keep up outward appearances at the Linwood house. She would borrow a lawnmower from a neighbor, and she and Terrell and Michael would groom the front yard. One afternoon when Terrell was in fourth grade, she remembers finding a cup of orange juice in the kitchen. She took a sip and discovered it wasn't orange juice, or rather, not just orange juice. It was what her dad called a screwdriver. orange juice mixed with the vodka that made him crazy and violent. She dumped out his bottle of vodka. Come what may for Terrell, the smallest girl in her class. He came in screaming, and he grabbed me by the arm. He dragged me to my room, and he spanked me with a belt. He was in a rage, she recalls. It hurt. A lot. It didn't stop her. Every time I could throw out his vodka, I did. She learned very early on to disassociate herself, to lock out the emotions. She says she didn't cry when he beat her. Her brother Michael cried, but not Terrell. Each morning and night, Terrell knelt beside her bed. Every night, the same prayers. Why couldn't I have been born into a family where my parents loved each other and were happy for their kids? She begged God to help her mother leave her dad. Terrell recalls that Kathy had a different plan. She decided there was a way to make things better. Relocate to a new place. So when Terrell was nearing the end of elementary school, they moved to a 3-bedroom apartment in Whittier, another tough city, and they lived in the rough part of it. And now the liquor store wasn't a few blocks away, it was directly across the street. Terrell had her own room, and so did Michael. Now they had a little brother, Mitchell. The kids didn't leave the apartment because they feared the gangs. Terrell didn't leave her room because she feared her dad. She escaped further into books. Nancy Drew, The Hardy Boys. There was a mild mystery in the house. Terrell says she was told not to answer the phone. She didn't think too much about it. It was just a rule. Don't answer the phone, Terrell. And she didn't. Better to follow the rules, take them on faith, not upset the delicate balance more than it would get upset on its own. During that period, she kept a diary. She had looping cursive that stood straight up. The entries would juxtapose the mundane thrill and confusion of being a young girl with the terror of living with Danny. On November 16, 1977, a few years before the gun incident, she wrote, "I talked to Greg Hertzberg yesterday. It was so good to talk to him. I really love him. I failed a math test today, but hope to get a good grade on the test tomorrow." And a few sentences later, "Mitchell can walk at 9 months now, and tonight we took movie films of him walking. Last night I only got 4 hours of sleep. Dad got drunk and started playing Michael's saxophone and would not stop. It was dreadful. He woke everyone and said that the reason he was playing it in the middle of the night was because that was the only thing or person or whatever that understood. Mom said she was glad something did. Tonight it's hidden under my bed." The months wore on. More fights. In January she scribbled, "I am writing this in the dark because I'm afraid of what Dad will do if he sees that the light is on." Michael started to get into drugs, Terrell explains. Pot when he could get it. When he couldn't, Terrell watched him sniff gasoline. After taking a big whiff of the gas, he'd pass out. The cycle of addiction was beginning to take hold. And Terrell felt the other ignominies in her life, such as sometimes showing up at school without a lunch. "Do you have anything left over?" Terrell recalls asking classmates in the cafeteria. "Can I have some of your chips?" Terrell and Michael sometimes would get silver dollars from their grandparents. When they were flush with a silver coin or two, they'd go to the local convenience store and buy food for breakfast or dinner, often splitting a pack of Hostess donuts. One evening when they were living in the new apartment, Danny came home loaded, in a rage. He threw Kathy and Michael out of the house. Then he came for Terrell. "You drunk son of a bitch! You are worthless!" she remembers screaming. He chased after her and grabbed her. She kicked and punched. "You are not getting me out of this house without a fight!" He got the better of her, bloodied her, put her out with the others. Terrell wrote in her diary, "This man cannot be my dad. I can't have come from someone this evil." She was furious at her brother, too. "Go fight back," she says she implored Michael. He was a big kid, not Danny's size, but big for his age. "When he comes after you, fight back." Her impression was that Michael and Kathy were peacemakers who wanted to stay under the radar, and that her mom felt she could change the dynamics by again changing the circumstances and the setting. She had a new plan. Move to Downey, a new community, a new start. It was the summer after Terrell's 9th grade year. Her room with the sheets tacked up for curtains also had a built-in desk, a chest of drawers, and a record player given to her by her grandparents. She had a Steve Miller album, but she wasn't much into music. Now she was an even more voracious reader. In fact, she'd gotten herself into trouble for the first time. The reason? She'd checked out too many books. Her favorites were The Didikoi, the story of an orphan girl who faces persecution, and The Secret Garden, where a girl and a boy who was sick escaped to a beautiful garden. She loved mysteries. She hated teen romance. She'd started to get into Stephen King. From the Downey Library, she would take out armfuls of books, 15 or even 20 at a time. She didn't always return them in time. She got a fine. $300. She couldn't pay it. But for as much of an emotional escape that reading provided, it couldn't protect her from the physical threats. It was not a sufficient one on that summer night when Danny burst into her room with a gun.
"Get in here. I want you to see this."
She was wearing a nightgown. She and Michael followed Danny's orders. Michael had come from his room and started to cry. Mitchell, their baby brother, was back in Michael's room, sleeping through it all, as he'd learned to do. Terrell and Michael followed Danny into their parents' small bedroom. It had hot pink walls. Kathy lay on the bed, her face streaked with mascara. Danny walked over to her. Terrell and Michael stood in the doorway. Now Terrell was crying too.
"Please, please put the gun down."
Terrell remembers her dad standing over her mom and pointing the gun down at her, pushing it toward her mouth.
"Please,"
Terrell says she and Michael begged. Kathy sobbed. Danny took a step back. He lowered the gun. Chapter 6. The Toll. After a harrowing day, it was Rendlesbacher's habit to talk about it, not bury it deeper. Things were so-so with his wife, Judy. He'd not been able to give the marriage quite the attention he'd have liked, having spent so much time in the military, traveling, and otherwise in and out of the home. Two of their kids were grown and out of the house, but that night, he sat down with the 17-year-old daughter, Allison.
"Please slow down. Please wear your seatbelt. Please don't be stupid when you're driving a car."
That night, his mind was racing with the events of the day. After he'd taken Reggie to the hospital, he'd escorted Kaiserman and the farrier's wife back to the scene. Then he'd driven the Crown Vic 10 minutes to the Cache County Sheriff's Office, a new building that housed the local law enforcement and was next to the jail. In the third-floor offices, Rendlesbacher typed in the witness statements. He loaded the photos from his personal camera to revisit the scene. In the photos, Jim's head lies back, his eyes closed, a crisscrossing of red blood across his head more suggestive of a bar fight than a fatal wreck. He's got short-cropped brown hair and a goatee. He looks to Rendlesbacher to be at peace.
"Not so much Keith."
He'd taken the brunt of the impact from Kaiserman's load. In the photo, Rendlesbacher could see Keith slumped forward, a hint of male pattern balding on top of his head. And there, in the back of the Saturn, a mass of pink and gooey stuff that had been sprayed on impact. Keith's brain. As Rendlesbacher retired for the night, he was juggling things he couldn't get out of his head. Kaiserman's statement that Reggie had crossed the yellow divider several times prior to the crash. Reggie's texting during the ride to the hospital. Reggie's inability to offer any other explanation for crossing the yellow line.
"If he'd said he was tired, I might have left it at that," Rendlesbacher says, looking back. "He could have lied to me, and I'd have had nothing to refute it."
"I want to see him."
"Ms. O'Dell, why don't we take care of this paperwork first?" the mortician said. It was the day after the wreck.
Leila had slept little, despite taking a sleeping pill around 11 p.m. During the day, she'd been inconsolable, barely able to speak to the family members who came by, sobbing with her daughter, Megan. Megan left in the evening.
She'd previously signed up for doing roadside security for the top of Utah Marathon, which was being held the next morning. But she had to be at her post that night, spending much of it guarding runners' possessions. Still, when Leila got to Allen Hall Mortuary the next morning, she was hoping to see Megan. But the young lady had slept in. Even absent the marathon, it was Megan's habit to stay up late, often playing video games, and then sleep late. Leila was determined to see Keith's body, but the staff was clearly trying to stall and even distract her. She complied with their request and gave them particulars, like Keith's social security number and a bunch of dates and names she rattled off. She selected a casket, something in a medium-colored oak that she thought Keith, a fan of natural wood, would like. She picked sunflowers, which she thought was like Keith, not roses or carnations. They asked when she'd like to have the funeral. It was Saturday. They decided Wednesday. And they decided to do it the same day as Jim's funeral, one following the next, because they had so many friends and colleagues in common. Leila asked again to see the body. Someone made it plain to her why she couldn't see it. Keith, her true love, was broken beyond anything imaginable. A man handed Leila a Ziploc bag. It contained a broken cell phone and a GPS, his watch, his car keys on a chain with a small compass on it, and the brown leather wallet he had made in his high school shop class and carried ever since. In another bag, she received his black lace-up shoes and his dark socks. Where are his glasses? Gone. This was all of Keith that remained. She couldn't bring herself to eat. She didn't pray. She'd become something akin to a zombie. More visitors came to the house. Megan showed up. Her life was already out of balance, and now her dad was dead. When she was a little girl, she and Keith would go geocaching together. He'd wake her in the middle of the night, and they'd use the big Deep Space Hunter telescope to look at a comet or other celestial event. They would throw the softball around in the yard. They played video games, the first being an early Star Wars game that they could play against each other after Keith used his wizardry to connect two computers together, an early jerry-rigged multiplayer game. Megan looked up to him. I wanted to be a rocket scientist like my dad. That's what I wanted to be, if I wasn't going to make the Olympics. But things started to sour for Megan and in her relationship with her parents in high school. Maybe it was because she switched to a bigger school, or maybe because she got her first boyfriend. Her grades dipped into the regular B's, then got worse. She swam less. Then, partway through high school, she said she was raped by a boy who lived near the big church. The boy had plied her with beer, she recalls. Her recollections were fuzzy. They came in and out. In the end, nothing came of the allegations. She felt her parents weren't supportive. Her grades worsened. She stopped swimming, thanks in part to an injured shoulder. On her high school graduation night, not long before the accident on Valley View Drive, her boyfriend got down on one knee at a campsite and proposed. Megan went home to show her parents the ring. She said her mom didn't approve. On the other hand, because of their souring relationship, Megan had asked her mother not to come to her high school graduation. As to her engagement, she said, her father seemed mostly supportive. I don't think either of my parents liked him, she said of her fiancé. My dad kind of went with it. Megan thought of her father as a tether, and he was gone. She needed something to wear to the funeral. She was low on funds. Leila looked inside Keith's wallet. As she suspected it would, it kept $100 and $20 bills, what Keith usually carried. She gave it to Megan to go with her aunt to the mall to buy something black. Among the visitors to the house was Tom Higgs, Keith's boss. Putative boss, really, given that Keith was the guy at the office answering questions. When Tom got to the Odells, he saw Leila in the living room shaking. She couldn't focus, Tom recalls. It was like trying to talk to someone who didn't have a reason to take the next breath. Can we see him? Asked Jim Farfaro's mom. She meant Jim's body.
The mortician nodded grimly. Jim's mom stood behind Jackie at Allen Hall Mortuary. The Fafaro family made their visit shortly after the Odell clan. Jackie already had her game face on, an almost impassive look, the grief held tightly inside. After falling apart, turning hysterical when the officers first told her in the classroom at Utah State, she recovered her outward composure. In the end, I was embarrassed that I'd fallen apart in front of anyone who knew me. That isn't my thing. After she told Cassidy, she put Stephanie to bed. The older girl, upstairs in her room, attempted to be brave herself. Tried to sleep. She could hear the relatives downstairs talking about it. She had put her hands over her ears and held them tightly, trying to make it all go away. A bit later, Jackie climbed into bed and pulled Jim's heavy terry cloth robe over herself. Eventually, unable to sleep, she took NyQuil. And then there was a pitter-patter of feet, and Stephanie crawled into bed, and they sort of slept the rest of the night under the robe that smelled like Daddy. In the morning, Jackie disengaged from the family that had gathered to pay respects and take her to the mortuary. She went into the bathroom, got in the shower, and sobbed. Heaved. Leaned against the wall, let the grief out. She reappeared 30 minutes later, drained, back in a modicum of control. Then at the mortuary, they put her through the same paces as they had Leila just an hour earlier. Jackie filled out paperwork and picked out a casket. Can we see him? Jackie wasn't particularly religious. Jim was a confirmed Catholic. But he and Jackie weren't into anything organized. Jackie had a general belief in God, tempered by a scientist's view of the world. As often as not, though, she relied on herself. She was the rock, a role she'd always taken to and sort of relished. I always felt like I was the shoulder. Jackie walked into the viewing room. Jim lay on a gurney covered with a comforter. Not a sheet, which struck Jackie, but a comforter. Light-colored with a flower print. They pulled back the cover. Dried blood trickled from Jim's ear. His right eye was missing. She touched his chest and head and hair. He was cold. She thought, he looks pretty good, given what they told me about the accident. She whispered, goodbye. Chapter 7. The Neuroscientists. I'm a tree freak. A 20-foot-high triangle palm stretches up from its pod in the middle of the main floor of Dr. Ghazali's studio loft. The palm divides the kitchen and the living room, which has a sleek black couch and a small Japanese maple in the corner. The couch faces a gas fireplace, a light blue flame burning. Over it hangs a glossy painting called Three Oaks, with three trees floating in the air against a yellow backdrop. The puffy trees look like brains. Alternative rock with an electronic beat pulses through the loft. The band is called Metric, says Dr. Ghazali. It's a new track, which is one of his rules when it comes to music. He won't put a song that's been out for more than a year on the playlist. I'm very into new bands. Dr. Ghazali pushes a button on the fireplace. A screen descends until it covers the top half of the fireplace, including the Three Oaks. It displays high-definition images shown from the projector hanging from the ceiling across the room. It's also connected to the PlayStation 3, so that he and his girlfriend, Joe Fung, can play video games, the current favorite being Assassin's Creed. Checkerboard windows stretch from the floor to nearly the loft's roof. They look to downtown San Francisco on a clear, chilly night. The street below the loft hums with activity. 20-somethings giddy on martinis. This is the Mission District, a gentrified hotbed of sushi, tapas, hip Mexican restaurants, and upscale furniture stores. Inside the Gaz Loft, the energy is starting to heat up. Tonight marks the party's 4th anniversary, and the host certainly wouldn't miss this Friday, even though he's already logged a huge day. It began in Florida,
where yesterday he spoke to a group, the College of Neuropsychopharmacology, something like that, he says. He could be excused for being tired. He got up at 3 a.m. California time. As soon as he flew home, he met an NBC crew which asked him to scan the brain of a multitasker for a segment for Dateline and the Today Show. I'm always in a hurry, Dr. Ghazali says, and he doesn't do anything halfway. I don't like to take on anything I can't blow away. He says his drive comes from a passion for science that had him as a kid, taking the bus 2 hours a day to and from a working-class neighborhood in Queens, New York, the son of blue-collar parents, mom was a bookkeeper, dad worked for the Transit Authority, to the world-class Bronx High School of Science. Despite excelling there and getting high SAT scores, he didn't get his first college choices. It intensified his drive, made him want to prove himself, but he says it also freed him to approach problems in his own way. The system failed me, so I decided I didn't need the system. He feels a buzz from his phone. He extracts it from his black jeans and reads. Oh, look at this. He holds up the phone and shows the text. I'm coming. Look out. It's from Philip Rosedale. He created Second Life, Dr. Ghazali says. It's one of the biggest virtual worlds ever created. Dr. Ghazali walks to the kitchen counter to show the text to a handful of people who have come early to eat prosciutto and soy chicken from Whole Foods. It's going to get crazy, Dr. Ghazali says. In addition to Rosedale, he's expecting a bunch of hipsters, rockers, and entrepreneurs. The guitars from the Counting Crows and the lead musician from Thievery Corporation. The guy who created Dig, an internet service that hundreds of millions of people use to rank whether or not they like something on the internet. Owners of some of the swanky nearby restaurants, and a gorgeous woman from the Caribbean named Rio, who professes to be in love with Dr. Ghazali's brain. Before the place explodes, Dr. Ghazali says there's time to explain the cocktail party problem. It is among the most fundamental precepts in attention science. As he talks, he makes a show of shifting his eyes to one of the handful of pre-party attendees, a pregnant woman named Kat who oversees HR for Burning Man. He explains that he's illustrating the cocktail party effect. I can look at Kat and still be listening to whoever I'm talking to, Dr. Ghazali says, then shifts his eyes back to me. Or I can look at whoever I'm talking to but shift my attention so that I'm listening to Kat. It's an exercise in selective attention. What he means is that people have a powerful, even extraordinary ability to direct their attention to control it. At the same time, he says, the cocktail party effect shows the limitations of attention. After all, you can't pay attention to two conversations at once. In fact, it's so limited that if you're really listening to the person in front of you, there are generally only two things you can pick up in a different conversation. The gender of the person speaking, or, in some cases, the sound of your name. There's an illusion that you have a whole field of attention, Dr. Ghazali says. The reality is that you can focus your attention on one very specific thing, not everything in your field of vision. Dr. Ghazali says the meaning of this principle is actually open to interpretation. On one hand, it shows you can control and focus your attention. But seen another way, the exercise shows how hard it is to spread your attention. It's more like a laser than an overhead light. Is that good or bad? It depends on whether you're an optimist or pessimist, Dr. Ghazali says. In short, attention is extremely powerful and extremely limited. That idea, as embodied by the cocktail party effect, is fundamental to modern attention science, and it seems so obvious. But it was quite revelatory in the middle of the 19th century. Up to that point, there was a general belief that the brain was infinite in its power to take in and process the world. If you touch your foot, you feel it. Immediately. Right? Until the middle of the 19th century, that thinking symbolized the prevailing scientific thought about the human neural network. In a nutshell, scientists believed that a human's reaction time was immeasurably fast, infinite, as some scientists put it. A person felt a prick and instantly recoiled, or saw a snake and leapt, or heard the sound of thundering hooves and stepped back off the street. What could prove otherwise? Try a galvanometer.
It was an early device used to detect and measure the magnitude of an electric current. Such gadgets were also employed to measure speed. How fast was a current traveling? The devices took various forms, but basically they used twisted metal coils to detect an electrical signal. When a galvanometer detected a signal, it created a magnetic field. The magnetic force, in turn, would cause a little pointer to move, allowing a researcher to measure when a current first appeared and when it dissipated. Early researchers used them in the field of ballistics to, say, measure the pace and trajectory of a bullet. Hermann von Helmholtz used one to measure the reaction time of a frog. Helmholtz was an associate professor at the Prussian University of Königsberg and one of the leading scientists of his day. He used an electric current to stimulate an amphibian's calf, then employed the galvanometer to measure how long it took the electrical current to run along the sciatic nerve. What he found changed the way scientists viewed the human brain. He discovered that what had looked instantaneous from the outside was, in fact, anything but, and not even close to the light speed. It took time for the current to travel to the brain. He tried it on a human being and discovered the same thing. Roughly, he estimated that neural conduction time was around 100 meters per second. It took 20 milliseconds for information to get from brain to calf. By comparison, light travels at about 186,000 miles per second. Helmholtz's use of the galvanometer symbolized not just how scientists were measuring human capacity, but why. The researchers realized that the machines people were building, those mechanized tools of productivity, war, and science, were so powerful that they were moving faster than people could keep up. This was a defining moment. Scientists were putting new technology to work to understand the capacities and limits of the human brain at the very moment that technology was putting those limits into sharp relief. It was not obvious that people were slow to respond until the 1850s. The increasing use of machines began to make this obvious, says Michael I. Posner, a professor emeritus of neuroscience at the University of Oregon, who was one of the modern pioneers of attention science and a student of its history. The relatively slow reaction time of humans wasn't clear until the pressure on people started to rise. Through the 19th century, technology quickly evolved. In 1837, across the ocean, Samuel Morse unveiled the first telegraph device, and 5 years later, Morse convinced Congress to provide $30,000 in support of his plan to wire the United States, according to a history compiled by the Massachusetts Institute.